Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Lynn Desner, attorney registration 39209. I'm here on behalf of the defendant appellant, Mr. Jared Massey. I'd like to reserve a few minutes of time for that one. It is fundamental to a criminal defendant's right to a fair trial that he cannot be convicted on the basis of past crimes or prior uncharged acts. 404B sets forth an important prohibition and rule that evidence of prior bad acts is never admissible to show the defendant has a propensity to commit the crime charged or to show the defendant has a bad character and acted in conformity therewith. Because of the significant danger of unfair prejudice, evidence of a defendant's past conduct is only admissible when it falls under certain narrow exceptions and is admitted in accordance with strict substantive and procedural guidelines. Under SCOTA, four factors must be met. The evidence must relate to a material fact. The evidence must be logically relevant. The evidence's logical relevance must be independent of the inference that the defendant committed the charged crime because of the likelihood that he acted in conformity with his bad character.
Ms. Nesner, I don't want to interrupt your flow, but I think we're pretty familiar with the SCOTA prong. So if you could focus on which the prongs you think were not satisfied here, or if the statutory provisions were not satisfied, that would be helpful to us.
Okay. I would argue that none of the prongs were met here. None of the threshold requirements were satisfied. With regards to the first and second prong, the relevancy determination, the court erred and did not perform any substantive analysis. The court acknowledged that the prosecution was seeking to introduce the evidence for a laundry list of purposes, including common plan, scheme, design, modus operandi, motive, guilty knowledge, lack of mistake or accident, and then found that the evidence was relevant to show that, but did not explain how the purposes pertain to material facts at issue. The only fact an issue that the court referenced was the defendant's intent to kidnap.
Ms. Nesner, in this case, if I remember correctly, the trial court told the jury that the evidence was admissible for eight separate purposes. For our purposes in deciding this case, do you think we need to address all eight of those purposes?
I did in addressing the issue. I mean, the state, in responding to their opening brief, only addressed two, if I recall.
Right, well, that's why I'm asking my question, because in your opening brief, you addressed all of the reasons set forth by the trial court, and Ms. Brady only addressed two of them. So I guess when rephrasing my question, I would ask if the grounds set forth by Ms. Brady are correct, does that mean, is that sufficient?
The jury was still instructed that it could consider the evidence for all the purposes, including purposes that were inapplicable, and then the instruction would be erroneous. I mean, the instruction has to limit the evidence to purposes, only the relevant purposes, and here it didn't.
Well, in the case of Usum versus the people, Justice Rice said that 404B evidence was admitted improperly, but then she went through all of the different grounds that had been proffered by the prosecution. So are you aware of any case where there have been lots of grounds offered by the prosecution and advised by the court to the jury, but nevertheless the court upheld the 404B evidence because there was at least one ground that was okay?
I'm not aware. I think if the jury's instructed, then they are going to use the evidence for those purposes. And so this court should consider whether the evidence was admitted for those purposes and cannot affirm the court's ruling and the admission of the evidence just because one purpose would uphold the admission of the evidence when the jury was told that the evidence was coming in for a whole broad range of purposes, so the jury could have used it for an impermissible purpose or could have been allowed to use it for broader purposes than it should have been, broader grounds than it should have been admitted for.
Well, let me ask you this question. Let's assume for purposes of the argument here that we were to agree with you on many of those purposes, but one of them we might not. And maybe it's the same way of asking the same question, but let me focus you on one of the issues that might be worth talking about a little bit more, was for the purpose of motive and intent, because I think that it was articulated both in the trial court and on appeal that the purpose was to show that Mr. Massey had a motive and intent to coerce his wife and did so in this case, and so prior instances of showing this motive and intent of coercion would have met the four-prong Spago test, and I would just like to hear your response to that.
I think that for the evidence to come in to show intent, it has to involve the same intent as the charged offenses. And the intent that we're talking about is not an intent to coerce his wife. That's not a fact at issue. That's not an element that the state needed to prove. That is, the state needed to prove that Mr. Massey knowingly seized and carried Mrs. Massey without her consent using a deadly weapon.
Isn't without her consent similar to being coerced? I mean, isn't this similar to, at least the Attorney General argues, is this similar to other situations where he was able to get her, get the victim to do what he wanted her to do?
Is it really similar? I mean, she testified that he would try to persuade her and barter with her to have anal sex, and she would often refuse. That's why she called it blue moon, because it only occurred once in a blue moon. So he was not always successful pleading with her. It was only three times, and the state charged Mr. Massey with using a deadly weapon. It wasn't a matter of him coercing her through bargaining about, you know, things with their children or in their marriage. He had a deadly weapon, a gun. The state's theory is that, and what she testified, is that she got back into the vehicle with him after she saw the gun because he pointed it at her and threatened to shoot her. I mean, she didn't. The testimony about their sexual life during their marriage 10 to 15 years earlier is very dissimilar. Because there was no, I mean, this was not evidence that five other times he threatened her with a gun. The coercion happened in this case based on a gun, not based on his pleading skills or his bartering. And the conduct is so different. I mean, for motive to apply, often motive is a permissible purpose when it provides a motive, like for when the other act would provide a motive for the charged crimes. For example, if he kidnapped her because she refused to have anal sex with him, then it should come in that she refused to have anal sex with him. That would be a reason to bring it in. Or if there was a common motive, then it could be more understandable that it should come in. Because I would argue that the evidence about their sexual life, his motive was sexual gratification. His motive here was to make his wife feel guilty when he was suicidal. He wanted to have her listen to him. And identity was not an issue, so this wasn't a case where motive was being brought in to show that, you know, this was the perpetrator. Motive is not really a contested issue for the state to prove, and to make it so broad as, well, he used coercion. I mean, that's to say he's a bully, which is what in Newsom they said the evidence couldn't come in to show that he was a bully.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Would it make a difference in this context where they're talking about cycle of violence? And how does it fit in there?
Cycle of violence to me is propensity. It's your defendant's propensity for violence. And it suggests repeated conduct. A cycle, like a loop of repeated conduct. This is not the same conduct. 10 or 15 years earlier, during the marriage, when they were happily married, having numerous kids, he was trying to do things that maybe she didn't always want to do. And then they get separated and he's suicidal. And if there were even sexual charges here, it would be different, but there's not. And the fact that there's a permissible purpose, I would argue that the intent is different, the motive is different. There's no similar. And it's not independent of like defendant's bad character. It relies on that. It relies on his propensity for violence, for being manipulative. I mean, being a manipulative, controlling person, that's propensity evidence. That's exactly what 404B prohibits.
I know you want to save some time, but let's assume we agree that this evidence should not have been admitted under 404B. Why isn't this harmless error? Why wouldn't that be harmless error?
Because this is a case where it was his word against her word. And
both the husband and the wife say that he had a gun when she saw the gun when she jumped out of the van. He had the gun when she was outside the van. He had the gun when she got back into the van. Didn't that go pretty far towards kidnapping anyway?
Well, he testified that she got back into the vehicle voluntarily.
Well, he's holding the gun.
I mean, he said that he just wanted to show her that it was unloaded, that he was telling her, I'm not going to hurt you. There are other differences. Like, if the jury were to believe his testimony, he said that he had access to the van and that he was free to use it, which for the motor vehicle theft would negate one of the elements. He said he never intended to hurt her, and that he never told her that he was going to tie her up. So, I mean, a lot of the differences between their testimony, if the jury had believed him, they might have just thought he was depressed and suicidal and wanted to speak to his wife and made a bad decision. But because the anal sex evidence came in, I mean, it's so damaging and inherently inflammatory. And that's the piece that I wanted to get to, I'm running out of time. But under 403, which is the final step, I mean, even if it made all the first three SPOTO prongs, it still couldn't pass the fourth because this is so inherently prejudicial. I mean, everyone has a reaction to anal sex. You say that and people, I mean, they have an immediate emotional reaction and an opinion about it, and often negative. I mean, many people think it's a deviant sexual practice. So for jurors that think it's deviant, they would form a negative opinion as soon as they heard he was interested in it. And then for jurors, and then once they heard he pretty much raped her, I mean, how is that not going to tip it in favor of the state? How is that not going to garner sympathy for her and destroy his credibility? I mean, he looks like a monster. I'm going to reserve the rest of the time, Rebecca. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nesner.
May it please the court, I'm Christine Brady, registration number 24779, representing the people. It seems that the court has two concerns today, and the first one is whether the evidence was properly admitted. Was the court's ruling, pretrial ruling, correct? And then secondly, taking a look at the jury instruction. Regarding the admission of the evidence, the prosecution didn't meet its burden of proof by offering a precise evidentiary hypothesis, and as we've already said, that was culpable mental state. the mental state to commit the offenses. So was the conduct knowing? If we know his intentions, his plan, his motive, that helps us to determine whether he knew he was coercing the victim and whether he was holding her without her consent.
Well, Ms. Brady, he was holding a gun in this instance.
That's
which was not similar with the prior instances. So how would the use of the prior instances go to whether he had an intent to coerce her when in this instance it's very dissimilar? He's holding a gun.
Right. The similarity really doesn't come in under 404B. The coercion of the sex acts, they were not entered as a means of showing a signature, an identical signature. Basically, that's usually only an issue when we're worried about identity, which of course was not an issue in this case. So it was not the similarity, it was the defendant's motive, his attitude towards the victim, and the way that he would coerce her until she acquiesced in the behavior that he wanted her to engage in.
Counsel, that's where I have the problem, because in the prior acts that the prosecution was allowed to bring in, it might go on for days or weeks before she would do what he wanted. I mean, he would stay out nights and not come home. He would go move in with his brother. He would not speak to her for days. Here, it's something very immediate. He wanted her to get in the car right away. And the theory of your case was, the people's case was, they had a gun, and he forced her in the car with a gun. So the fact that he before wheedled and badgered and was obnoxious, what's that got to do with? Here he's forcing her to get into a car instantaneously, not, well, maybe he'll get in the car today or maybe next week or something like that. It seems like there's a problem connecting those two.
Well, first of all, with the gun, he claimed he never pointed the gun at her. He claimed that the gun was just there originally in his bag, he was going to use it later, and the only reason why the gun came into it was because she saw it when he went to pick up the sodas inside the bag to give her a soda. So he did deny that. So there was some conflicting testimony there about whether she was forced with the gun or not. That is what she testified, but he testified and he denied it. But secondly, this is about psychological coercion that has gone on for years. So it's not so much in the past incidents did it take several days before she would finally acquiesce. It was, what was the defendant's attitude towards the victim? Could he coerce her, and would she eventually acquiesce?
Ms. Brady, what does the record show about how recent, the most recent of the 404B evidentiary acts took place?
I believe that the acts that were admitted, and there were three of them, were within a decade. They weren't just, you know, they weren't yesterday. There were other acts that were more recent, I believe, that were not admitted.
So are you aware of any cases dealing with 404B or 186801.5 that deal with evidence that was presented of arguably similar acts that occurred such a long time before the event for which the defendant was charged?
I know that remoteness in time is sometimes a consideration under 404B, but it's not determinative.
So does that mean that you're not aware of any cases?
Not at this time.
I'm just asking because, I mean, we have lots of cases, as you know, where there's a prior course of domestic violence or history of domestic violence that's admitted, but usually it's within the previous weeks or months before the incident in question. This seems like it's significantly different in that regard.
It is different, but I believe that the cases that you were talking about and where it's admitted there because it's been, for instance, a few days before murder, I believe that's admitted under a different theory, which would be res justae, which is not it's not a relevance theory that was used in the trial court's findings here.
There was evidence, excuse me.
No, go ahead.
Was there not, that she said that this conduct was ongoing throughout their entire marriage?
Yes.
Is that sufficient to tie up the remoteness, that kind of vague testimony?
Well, I think it's sufficient. In some cases, it wasn't vague. I mean, she did talk about other psychological coercion, where he would tell her that she was worthless, and there was some testimony that, I think she testified that, he pretty much well kept her at home. That was what the whole seven kids was about in a 10-year period. You know, kept her home and pregnant and was very jealous for her to be outside the home. There was some evidence of that.
Ms. Brady, if I might, I would like to ask you a question about the 18.6801.5 and its applicability here. That statute says that the prosecution shall specify which of the grounds it's relying on. And here, the prosecution relied on like six or seven or eight different grounds. Is that, in your view, consistent with the statute?
Actually, I think it's okay that both the prosecutor and the trial court did talk about motive, and certainly in the closing argument, both closing arguments was all about motive. And motive is part of the cycle of violence. As a matter of fact, in most of the cases, the cycle of violence evidence, both the expert and any victim testimony, is because of the motive.
Well, no, my question, though, is we're not focusing on motive, but whether it's consistent with the statute for the prosecution and then for the trial court to, in effect, use a scattershot approach and say, well, we're relying on all of these different grounds listed in the statute, and maybe one of them will be okay.
I see what you're saying.
Is that okay, especially in light of the reference in the Usum case to the prosecution carelessly grouping different grounds under 404B together?
Well, it's okay is kind of a vague word too.
I was trying to use a precise legal word.
Well, I think I was using it as well, but I think it's okay for the district attorney to rely on just one purpose for the purposes of admission.
Right, but the question is not whether the district attorney can rely on one purpose and say motive and then run with that and then have the trial court rule on that. But what happens when the prosecutor relies on six or seven or eight grounds and then the trial court says, okay, the evidence is admissible under all those bases, and then on appeal you say that was defensible on the basis of motive and intent, and then Ms. Nestor is arguing, well, yes, but the jury wasn't instructed that the evidence was admissible for six other purposes that you didn't say were proper in your brief.
Right, well, we're talking about two different things. We're talking about admission on the one hand, and then what did the jury instructions say? For the admission, we don't even need trial court findings. This court can just rely on the record, and as long as the record supports one of those reasons, then it was properly admitted. Then we get to the second part, which of course is the jury instruction. The jury instruction here, the trial court correctly told the jury twice and very clearly that it was not to consider the evidence for any other purpose than those listed. Now, it did give the laundry list of purposes. The instruction here did do that. Generally, the laundry list is disapproved, and it's not the better practice. It is a better practice where you just list each of the purposes that is relevant to this case. And you look at the closing argument to see what the prosecutor argued. Here in the closing argument, the prosecutor did argue almost all of the purposes, except for modus operandi. So that would be one purpose in there that would make this laundry list a true laundry list and not specific.
Let me ask you a question just to clarify the record a little bit.
Okay.
It was also admitted for cycle of violence, but the jury was not instructed on cycle of violence?
The jury was not, correct. There was expert testimony on cycle of violence, and there was argument in both closing arguments about cycle of violence, but I don't believe there was a separate instruction. However, the laundry list That's in the jury instruction. Those are all the purposes under the cycle of violence statute. My last point about the jury instruction is, although the laundry list is disapproved, there hasn't been a case in Colorado that I could find that reverses on that basis.
Okay. I have one other question to ask you about step four of the SPOTO analysis.
Yes.
Did the trial court make a specific finding on step four?
Yes. The trial court found that the evidence was highly probative of mental state in its written ruling, and that's in the court file CD page 239.
How do you respond to Ms. Misner's point that this evidence is so prejudicial, so highly charged, that it is really inconceivable that it couldn't be a harmful error,
right.
that it would be harmless error?
Right. Well, inconceivable is a very, very broad rule.
She didn't say that, I'm saying.
I think that's basically what she's trying to argue, is that once you hear something about anal sex, that all bets are off and it should never be admitted.
Well, and there was evidence brought in that he said, I pretty much raped you, or words to that effect.
Correct. That,
the
was,
rape
what,
was used.
That was the victim's testimony.
Yes.
Again, the defendant testified, and he denied all of that.
No, but she put it in.
She did put it in.
Denied.
That's correct. I think the trial court did consider that. Obviously, the trial court knew that the evidence was about coercion and anal sex, and it still found, and I would argue it did not abuse its discretion in this finding, that the highly probative value of mental state, since that was what was at issue with the crime of kidnapping, far outweighed the prejudicial effect, because the evidence is always going to be prejudicial. That's why we have to have an exception to let it in. It's usually not admissible.
If the trial court concluded that the probative value outweighed the prejudicial effect,
mm-hmm.
Let's say we conclude that he nonetheless was wrong on the third or the second or third spoke prong of the of SPOTO, and we would conclude that he admitted the evidence impermissibly. Are you saying that finding requires us to determine that it was harmless error?
When you say the third, are you saying that this was admitted for propensity?
Whatever, I'm just saying it.
Okay.
Assuming we conclude that for a reason other than the fourth prong, that the evidence was impermissibly admitted.
I would say it's still not reversible error because, well, for two reasons. One thing is it's rebutting not only the defendant's theory, but the defendant's testimony that he was not coercing. And you can bring evidence in on rebuttal that's ordinarily not admissible. But the better reason and the overall reason is the evidence was pretty overwhelming. It was at least very abundant. The defendant's own testimony was pretty damning. When on the one hand he said he had no plan, and then later on did say that he had a plan. As a matter of fact, he called it a vision, that he was going to get alone and he was going to keep her with him so that he could talk to her about how she had wrecked his life, and that she would just sit there and take it and feel bad about it. And that was basically his testimony.
If the testimony was he was denying that he had a gun to have her either sit outside the van or get back into the van, which I believe
correct,
that was the factual basis for the kidnapping charge, how is the he said, she said, how is it overwhelming evidence on that?
Well, on the one hand, it is about credibility and is a he said, she said. But I think it's overwhelming because he told the district attorney while he was testifying, I guess you got me on that. I did have a plan. This was my vision.
Okay.
The people will request that this court affirm defendant's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brady.
I'd like to return to that 403 analysis.
According to McCormick, the last step requires the court to consider a variety of matters in balancing the balancing assessment, such as the similarities between the acts, the interval of time that elapsed between the prior acts and the charged offenses, the need for the evidence, and the degree to which the evidence will probably arouse the jury to overmastering hostility. But it's not just, you have to weigh the actual probative value against the prejudice. And here there was other evidence that could have served. I mean, the jury didn't need to hear that 10 years earlier during their marriage he had been a controlling jerk to make a decision as to whether they should believe him or her on the events 10 years later after they're separated.
I think your time is up.
Yes. Okay, Mr. Massey would ask this court to reverse his convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Messner. Thank you again, Ms. Brady. We appreciate both of your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.